Nicola Benyahia grew up in Wales. She converted to Islam in her late teens, but considered herself Western liberal. She married a Muslim, and the family, which included five children, moved to Birmingham, England, which Nicola and her Algerian husband found more diverse. And it came as a shock when their happy-go-lucky, energetic 18-year-old son decided to join a conservative mosque, to fast more than the standard Ramadan observances, to distance himself from his family. Then Rashid Benyahia disappeared at the end of May 2015. He boarded a flight to Turkey, made his way to Syria to join ISIS, and died fighting alongside ISIS in Iraq after an airstrike. His mother grieved and then started a group for other parents to share signs of radicalization and maybe prevent it. Nicola Benyahia joins us from the BBC studios in Birmingham. Welcome.
Thank you.
And this was a terrible loss not that long ago, so very sorry.
Thank you.
And sorry, too, when we see these pictures of your son. You know, he loved parkour, and so there's pictures of him doing cartwheels, you know, through a park. Every single picture, he's very young-looking, smiling. What did you think when that started to change?
I kind of just thought he was going through some sort of teenage angst, really. My daughters, I have four daughters, and they'd gone through kind of the teenage stuff as well. So being a boy, I thought maybe he was just going through it in a different kind of way. But it was, again, over about a year and a half period when sort of small things started changing that were kind of more religious. And that was what was concerning me more than anything.
Right. Because he'd been attending a mosque with his dad that was moderate. And then he decided, you know, he wanted to seek out this other conservative mosque. He started reading Islamic literature. You'd not heard of the authors. It must have felt like some stranger taking your son.
It did. I would say, particularly the last sort of 6 to 8 months, there was a big change within his own character. Because, as you said before, he was a very smiley, very happy-go-lucky. I can't remember a time where he ever became angry or was kind of unhappy. And so when he became more rigid and he wasn't joining in with the fun in our family life, that was what was the most significant for me. That was really, really out of character and strange for me.
Look, I mean, you know, this comes to a terrible end, and we'll get to a little more of the timeline. But do you feel now, is there something I should have done in that moment? Should I have gone to our imam from our, you know, moderate mosque? Should I have gone to a therapist? Should I have searched his room? Is there something you regret not having done, having had that terrible feeling?
Obviously, you know, on hindsight and looking back, I've reflected constantly about the past. And looking back at the time, with the tools and what I knew at the time, really, I couldn't have changed anything. I didn't have the right people around me. I didn't have the right skills. I didn't have the right knowledge. At the time, I just did the best I could as a mother. And there wasn't an awful lot, really, of assistance or help, really, in the UK.
Well, the other thing that happened is that as this is going along, Rashid suddenly had a moment where sunshine came back. He gave you a gift. He seemed to be his old self. But what do you now realize it was?
I realise now it was we call it the preparation mode. He'd actually had made that decision to actually go over to Syria. It's the same as if somebody's very, very depressed and they're going to commit suicide. They're very depressed before they make that decision to commit suicide. And then when they've made that decision, sometimes they become uplifted. They come out of the depression, but actually it's because they've made that decision.
Well, then he disappears. Officials have you look at surveillance footage from the airport. Yep, that's him going to Turkey. But it takes quite a while before you figure that out. He's joined up with ISIS. You do begin to hear from him. How did he sound?
The first call I got from him after he'd been missing about 2.5 months, he was exactly the same. He was slightly panicky because he'd known that he hadn't been in touch for nearly 3 months. So I could hear his voice shake. He was full of emotion because he'd just been released from a camp. The homesickness and missing us was just all coming out. But after that, I almost had to view it. The phone calls I got from him, I had to literally, to get through them, I had to view it as if he was just at college down the road. Because I would not have been able to get through those phone calls with him had I really understood where he was.
And also, you felt that if you were really too tough with him, you might lose him forever. At least in this case, you had some contact.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And he would tell you things like some Islamic leader had proposed finding him a jihadi bride, and he wasn't sure he wanted that. Did you ever, though, want to say, what are you doing? Come home. You're in over your head.
I did say it many times, but eventually I stopped saying it because he was trapped, especially when I found out they'd taken his passport off him. So I knew that even if he wanted to come out, it was going to be incredibly difficult. And I didn't want to put that pressure on him, because if he decided he wanted to get out, he needed to be emotionally and psychologically and everything really, really strong.
Then you get the phone call.
Yeah.
That he'd been killed in an airstrike.
Yeah.
Something probably you'd maybe even been expecting.
I had been expecting it, because I heard the stories from other mothers and other parents who had had similar stories. And I knew it was only literally every day that passed was just an extra day that he was living. Psychologically and emotionally, I was preparing myself for that call.
Was it from an ISIS fighter?
Yes, it was.
Well, what did they say?
They said, you know, are you the parents of Rashid? And, we confirmed, we said yes. And he said, I'm really sorry to tell you, but your son's been killed. He was hit by an airstrike and he was taken outright. But I think what was very difficult for me, which kind of hurt me and upset me, was he just turned around and he even began to cry himself and said, your son was a very, very good boy. He was a very respectful boy. I thought, if you knew that, why did you do this to him?
Did you have the temptation to say that?
Unfortunately, my husband was on the phone at the time when they said this. Had it been me, I think I would have probably ripped into him.
Well, or said to him, it's not too late for you to get out. Look, it's bad enough to get this news, but it came a week after militants killed 130 people in Paris. This was the terrible shooting at the club. And how did you wrestle with that, knowing that that could have been your son?
Whenever there was any kind of attack or anywhere, you know, even when my son was out in Syria, it scared me thinking, you know, what if they made him return or made him do something? So anything that was on the news or in the paper, it never went out of my mind that that could be possibly my son, that they could make him do something. So in a way, as awful as it sounds coming from a mother, part of me was glad that he died when he died, because I no longer had to fear thinking that he may do something like that.
And I'm thinking, too, it must have been almost impossible for you to express your grief at your loss when the loved ones of these 130 people had been killed by militants like your son.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, my grief was hidden anyway. Even when I got the call, life carried on completely as normal. I went to work. We all carried on doing our things because nobody knew. Our family or friends didn't know anything that we were going through.
Wait, nobody knew?
Very, very few people, maybe a handful of people knew about, but hardly anybody knew about what we were going through at all.
And I have to say, you know, again, seeing the pictures of your son, it's impossible to see how this could have happened, which makes you the person, I would think, to tell other people, you think it's impossible with your child, but it's not. What do you say to these other families now in this new group that you founded, Families for Life? What are you advising them to do? I mean, I'm sure parents are petrified. How do you spot this?
I think it's going with your gut feeling, because there aren't these magical signs. The family will have a gut feeling or there's something not quite right. And what I do with the families is make sure that I validate that and I work through that with them.
And then what? I mean, if they have a child who suddenly joined a more conservative mosque, wearing more conservative Islamic clothing, reading certain authors, how do you stop it?
I think I always encourage the family to have the authorities on board as well. You need a whole team around that family and the individual to kind of really sort of intervene with this. And everyone has a part to play, whether it's the sort of our social services here, our welfare, whether it's the police authorities. Everybody has their part around that individual to de-radicalize them. But meanwhile, I'm there to support them emotionally and psychologically, because the radicalization can change from sort of week to week. And they have to obviously live with this individual and cope with them. And that can be incredibly draining on their own mental health as well.
Hmm. What do you say to families that might be, even be immigrant families? They don't trust the authorities and they might be afraid that in contacting, you know, police, for instance, their son is definitely going to be taken away.
I try to encourage them because there's a lot of negativity out there about the authorities. And I do say there's another side as well. I mean, I know the authorities with us were incredibly respectful. They were very open with us and we were open with them as well. But also, if they are concerned about going to the authorities, at least they can come to me. And then I kind of encourage them as well to go to the authorities or go to their, you know, the social services.
Well, better to have your son, you know, talked to by police then talked to by ISIS.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah.
Nicola Benyahia, the founder of Families for Life, a group dedicated to spotting and combating Islamic radicalization in UK youth. Her son Rashid was killed after he joined ISIS in 2015. Nicola, again, sorry for your loss, and thank you for talking to us.
No problem. Thank you very much.
Imagine telling another parent, I'm sorry, your child isn't returning to his old bubbly self. He's probably about to leave and join ISIS. We'll link you to her group at hereandnow.org.